Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care, and we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
My name is Bill Domnarski, and we're doing a podcast for the New Books Network today with Aziz Haque, who is a professor of law at the University of Chicago. Aziz, what else can you tell me about yourself and, for instance, how you got to the University of Chicago?
Sure. I graduated from the university at Columbia University Law School in 2001. I did two federal clerkships. I worked for a year for an organization called the International Crisis Group, which does geopolitical analysis of conflict, and I worked for them in Afghanistan. And then I spent about 5 years working for the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU, doing litigation on voting rights and on civil liberties in the national security space before being hired by the University of Chicago Law School, where I've been for 13 years.
How many years?
I'm sorry, and I'll explain to your listeners that I have a slight sore throat. the product of having two young boys to shout at. I've been here for 13 years.
Oh, that's great. Your book is called The Collapse of Constitutional Remedies. Now, remedies is a word that often shows up in discussions about law, and it's always paired with rights. Rights and remedies is one of the few phrases that actually has a ring to it in the law. Tell us what the difference is between rights and remedies.
So the Constitution contains a broad array of individual entitlements. Many people are familiar with the right to free speech. Many people are familiar with the right against unreasonable searches and seizures under the Fourth Amendment. And we can go on. There's rights to due process, equal protection, the Second Amendment rights with respect to firearms. The Constitution, although it contains a broad range of rights, does not say all that much about how those rights will be enforced. In fact, there are only two provisions in the Constitution that even gesture at the way in which a right will be realized. What this means is that the Constitution commits or restrains government through the articulation, through the speaking of an array of important individual interests, but does not say how those interests will be translated into a practical reality in most cases. So there is a gap between, on the one hand, the constitutional text, which is rich in rights, and the very consequential question of how those rights will be realized in practice.
Right. Let me interrupt you and ask a question. Was that intended by the founders, this gap you're talking about?
It was intended in the sense that the founders made certain assumptions about the scope of government, the nature of the risk that a right would be violated, and the availability of background mechanisms through which rights violations could be remedied. So the assumptions that I think are most important to your question are first, that the Bill of Rights initially applied only to the federal government. It didn't apply to the states. And the federal government, for much of the first century of American history, was not that large. There wasn't that much of a federal government. There weren't many agents of the federal government who could go about violating individual rights. Moreover, the assumption at the time of the founding was that there would be ordinary civil courts, including state courts, that could provide remedies for federal action that violated a constitutional right. Indeed, up through the Civil War, if a federal officer unlawfully detained an individual, a state court would be available to provide a remedy for that detention. We've completely lost that idea of the potential role of state courts with respect to the defense of federal rights, in part because the Civil War and the aftermath of the Civil War reoriented our understanding, reoriented the constitutional understanding of the relationship between the states and the federal government.
Did the states grudgingly enforce these rights in, say, the 19th century? Because there was tension between federal rights, I mean, the federal government and state governments as to who really had the upper hand in deciding what was going to happen.
So the record of states with respect to the enforcement of constitutional rights is complex and varied. On the one hand, states did protest actively through the political process actions that they saw as being unlawful by the federal government. So there was a pattern of political protestation with respect to the Alien and Sedition Acts that were passed under the Adams administration. There was resistance by southern states, famously, to what was called the Tariff of Abominations. So there's lots of political protest happening on the part of the states. On the other hand, there aren't that many instances in which there's a federal action that is coercive, that targets an individual, and where the individual turns to a state court for protection. Those cases tend to arise in moments of open conflict. So, for example, during the War of 1812, when state courts in, for example, New York, did provide remedies for what they viewed as unlawful federal detention of people who had been impressed into the National Army.
All right, so there's one tension between the states and the federal government, but within the government itself, the federal government, there's a tension between Congress and the courts. You spend the first few chapters of your book talking about that. Can you sketch that out for us?
Sure. The federal government that's created through the Constitution of 1787 has three branches. We talk today about those three branches as being independent of each other and co-equal. The original design of the federal judiciary, the federal courts, however, was intended to create a body of tribunals, a body of judges who would be independent of the political process. And the framers made certain design decisions about how the courts would operate and made certain assumptions about their operation that have informed the nature of judicial independence. The framers decided to protect the independence of the courts, not by protecting the institution of the courts, but by focusing upon individual judges. So the federal courts don't actually have any guaranteed power over particular kinds of cases, except for a very small class of instances. There's no, the Congress, that is, has broad authority to decide what kinds of cases the federal courts can hear. And indeed, Congress has exercised that authority over time. Rather than protecting the institution of the federal courts, the drafters of the Constitution decided to protect independence at the level of the judge. Now, there's two ways in which you can do that. One way is you can have an appointment procedure that shelters the judge from political influence, that ensures an apolitical appointment mechanism. This is used in many countries around the world today. The other way in which you can protect judicial independence at the level of the judge is by giving them after-the-fact protections, giving them protections against being fired or punished. The framers decided on the second and not the first form of protection for judges. Judges sit so long as they show what's called good behavior, and they the conventional understanding is that they cannot be removed except through impeachment. However, judges are appointed in a process that runs through the president and the Senate, two bodies that are elected and that are overtly political. The framers, however, believed that the political nature of the appointment process would not be a problem, would not create a partisan judiciary. Why? Because they made two assumptions about the world. And these assumptions are stated explicitly in the Federalist Papers written by Hamilton. The first assumption is that the Senate would be an apolitical body. It would be a body that stood above partisanship. The second assumption was that there were so few qualified lawyers that neither the president nor the Senate would have wiggle room to pick lawyers who shared their partisan preferences. There'd be so few people. Only the president's hands would be tied when selecting judges, because there would only be a very limited number of qualified candidates.
Now, let me ask you, were those assumptions ever actually true? I imagine on the supply of qualified judges, what is to say, good lawyers, that was probably true. But what about the other assumption that you described?
Right. The second assumption was likely true, at least through the 1790s, maybe the early 1800s, because there were not law schools in the United States. The first law schools are set up in Harvard, and then there's another dedicated law school that's set up, I think, in New England in the 1790s.
Litchfield?
That might be right. The assumption about the Senate, though, is interesting. The theory of the Constitution was that the national government, and in particular the Senate and the presidency, would stand above politics, would not be characterized by what James Madison famously called factions. This quickly proved a flawed assumption. Even in the first decade of the Republic, both in the House and the Senate, you saw very, very clear patterns of partisan voting. So from the very beginning of the Republic, it was clear that the Senate was not going to be a body that stood above factions. And certainly the House was not a body that stood above factions, as you saw in the contested election of 1800. So the assumption about how the national government would work was tested and failed within the first decade. The consequence of these two assumptions failing is that the appointment process for federal judges is open to partisan influences. And particularly at moments in time when partisanship is strong at the national level, and we've gone as a nation through moments of high levels of polarization, low levels of polarization, and we're back in a moment of high levels of polarization. When partisan polarization is at the national level is high, we should expect to see judicial appointments that reflect partisan interests. And judges whose beliefs and values that are inevitably playing a role when they come onto the bench, are influencing the manner in which they make decisions, particularly where those decisions are not constrained by some clear piece of constitutional text. One consequence of this openness of the federal judiciary to partisan influences is the changing pattern of individual remedies for constitutional wrongs over time. That is, judges who've had historically wide discretion over what remedies there will be for constitutional violations have changed the volume or the availability of remedies in light of the interests that they have brought to bear by dint of the partisan process through which the federal bench is constituted.
All right, let me interrupt and say, or ask two questions. One is, and this is probably an unfair question, can you give us an idea of the quality of the judges in the 19th century, these appointments? And second of all, the enforcement of these remedies, at least the recognition of the remedies, was that a whimsical thing for these judges, or were they disciplined? Did they recognize the need for the remedies to be enforced?
So let me take up both of those in turn. So during the first half of the 1800s, federal judicial appointees come directly from the political classes. People like John Marshall, who is famous as one of the early chief justices of the Supreme Court, are overtly partisan figures. Marshall was the Secretary of State for John Adams before he becomes chief justice. Indeed, there's a period of time during which the he's serving both as Secretary of State and as Chief Justice, which is certainly questionable as an ethical matter. Through the 1840s and 1850s, the bench, including the Supreme Court, is comprised of judges who are members of the partisan political classes engaged in the dynamics of national political contestation, including over sectional conflict that will become the Civil War. A famous example of this is the leak. People have been talking about the Dobbs leak, but there have been earlier leaks. The leak of the Dred Scott opinion to President Buchanan. President Buchanan is tipped off about by one of the judges of the Supreme Court of how the Dred Scott case will come out. And Buchanan turns around and tries to lobby one of the dissenters to change their vote. This is possible because we're in an age in which judges and justices are highly, highly political creatures, and everyone recognizes them as such. On your second question, so federal courts are not doing all that much by way of granting individual remedies in the first half of the 1800s. There are cases in which they are essentially hearing what's called a tort action under state law or under the common law against federal officials and granting damages. There are some cases of that kind, but there are not that many, in part because there's just not that many federal officials. It's only in the wake of the Civil War, when the Reconstruction Amendments impose a new set of constitutional constraints upon the several states, and when you start to have conflict over rate regulation and efforts to constrain cartels by the states, and then contestation over labor and union organizing, that courts start to become much more aggressive about giving remedies for what they perceive as constitutional violations. And the kind of remedies that you see being given in the late 1800s and the early 1900s reflect the nature of or the partisan interests of the judiciary at that point in time. Let me explain that. After the Civil War, the Republican Party turns toward the project of industrialization, turns toward the project of enabling the commercial republic to grow. And in the 1870s, as it looks as if they're about to lose power, they're losing national elections, aggressively expands the array of lower federal courts and does their best to stack those federal courts with Republican appointees. Those appointees share the nationalistic and commercial values that their party have. And one of the things that we see in consequences in the 1880s and 1890s, federal courts first identify the liberty of contract as a constitutional value, and second, start to grant much more aggressively injunctions against state governments that are aiming to enforce rate regulation that violates what was then called the liberty of contract. So what you see in the late 1800s and early 1900s is the use or the development of injunctions, first against states that are trying to regulate businesses, and then second, against unions that are trying to organize workplaces in ways that are at odds with the constitutional and vision of these judges, Republican judges appointed in the 1870s in particular. This lasts until about the 1930s or 40s. We have a process of political change where the underlying idea of liberty of contract is first critiqued, attacked by the FDR administration, and then abandoned. In the 1940s and 50s, you have Democratic judges appointed by the Roosevelt and then the Truman administrations. And those, the pattern of appointments, particularly under FDR, was focused on finding judges who would be more sympathetic to individual rights claims on the part of blacks in the American South. Roosevelt was concerned with breaking the power of Dixiecrats within his coalition. He can't do it directly, and so he looks to the courts as a way of loosening the stranglehold that Dixiecrats have on political power in the South. And it's because of that partisan pattern of appointments and the willingness of those judges to grant individualized remedies, first in desegregation cases, but then importantly later also in criminal procedure cases, where they perceive the criminal justice system of the South as being an instrument of Jim Crow. Right. It's the partisan agenda of those judges Democratic judges that leads to a dramatic expansion in what we now think of as individualized remedies against state violence, which until the 1950s and early 1960s simply don't exist at any scale in the federal courts.
Let me interrupt and ask a different question.
Yeah.
How would things have been different if the Bill of Rights, the rights contained in the Bill of Rights, had been applied to all the states, the incorporation doctrine? How would things have been different as the decades played out? I think there was a battle fought by Hugo Black, for instance, about incorporation. He wanted all of them incorporated. People like Felix Frankfurter did not. How would things have been different if the entire Bill of Rights applied to the states?
Well, we would have had a fundamentally different country from the get-go. The Bill of Rights was understood from its inception to apply only to the federal government. That's confirmed in an 1833 case called Barron v. City of Baltimore. And even after the Civil Rights the Civil War Amendments, the 13th, 14th, and the 15th, the Supreme Court is extremely unwilling to constrain the states using the federal constitution. Indeed, the very first interpretations of the 14th Amendment in particular are consciously and explicitly narrow in light of the justices' concerns with not disturbing state sovereignty and state autonomy. It's only in the 1880s and 1890s where you have the wave of Republican judges that I describe being appointed, identifying the liberty of contract as a value under the 14th Amendment, and then imposing constraints upon the states pursuant to the liberty of contract. This largely meant striking down laws, and granting injunctions against the enforcement of rates, for example. It wasn't remedies for individual state violence. That you did not see. It's only in the wake of the 1930s and the discrediting of that vision of liberty of contract that you start to see the debate about incorporation that Bill, you mentioned, and importantly, the development by the court of procedural vehicles through which incorporated rights against state coercion can be enforced by individuals. It's only in the 1950s that you see the court extend the right to damages against unconstitutional state violence to state actors as opposed to federal actors. It's only in the 1950s that you see the federal remedy for unlawful detention, which is called habeas, being opened up to people who are detained by the states as opposed to the federal government. And it's only in the early 1960s that you see an effectual remedy for Fourth Amendment violations, violations of the right against unreasonable searches and seizures, being enacted against the states in the form of the exclusionary rule, the rule that if a police officer obtains evidence in violation of the Fourth Amendment or the Fifth Amendment, it cannot be used in a criminal trial. So incorporation happens in the 1930s, but incorporation isn't going to bite on states until the court in the 50s and 60s develops this array of remedies.
All right. So we have this relationship between Congress and the courts. And you're saying, I think, that in the 19th century, it was a profound, the congressional influence was profound by drafting legislation, passing legislation, dealing with jurisdiction. Also the size of the courts, where the courts are. So we get into the 20th century. It sounds like there's an ascension of the individual judges and their personalities and their ideas of the way the country should move. You talk about in the 50s, you talk about this cadre of liberal justices who transform individual rights on the criminal side. That would be Warren, Brennan, Hugo Black, Douglas. Does it matter when it comes to the legitimacy of these granted rights that they were granted by this kind of coalition of both parties? It was bipartisan. Some of these justices were appointed by Republican presidents, Eisenhower, and some by Democratic presidents, Truman and Roosevelt. Does that give those rights any more weight, do you think?
Well, can I just step back a second and unpack something you said earlier in your question?
Yes.
So let me draw a distinction between two aspects of the federal courts, one of which has remained constant and one of which has changed over time. What's remained constant is that we have an appointment process that is open to partisan influences. Presidents make appointments that reflect values and beliefs that are aligned with their party. That was true in the 1870s, it was true in the 1950s, and it's true today. That's one thing that has remained constant over time. One thing that has changed, however, over time is the institutional heft, the institutional weight of the federal courts. So the federal courts go from being a relatively skeletal operation through the antebellum period to being bulked up in the 1870s and to accruing their own bureaucracy in the form of the administrative office and their own capacity to lobby in the early 20th century. So the federal courts become more institutionalized in the late 1800s and early 1900s, but that doesn't change the fact that the appointment process is still porous to partisan forces. So that's a subtle distinction between independence at the level of the individual and independence at the level of the institution. And you've seen a lot more institutional independence over time, but you haven't seen any change to the porousness to partisan forces in the appointment process. You asked a question about the remedies that were granted in the 1940s and the 1950s. The 1940s and the 1950s are a period in which the two major political parties in the United States, the Republicans and the Democrats, are not that far apart. They're not that far apart because there are cross-cutting cleavages that run across the partisan dividing line. There are both Southern Democrats and Southern Republicans. The race line or conflict over race, that is, hasn't become aligned with conflict over party identity. One of the consequences of that is that in the 1950s, 40s and 50s, you can have both Democrats and Republicans appointing judges who are willing to take action against Jim Crow institutions. They're willing to put their weight behind the desegregation project of Brown v. Board of Education. They're willing to allow federal courts to step in to state criminal justice processes where those criminal justice processes look corrupt or tainted by racial influence. Now, one thing that happens over the second half of the 20th century is that the existence of cross-cutting cleavages with respect to party identity falls away. Party identity comes to be more and more identified with views about race, views about law and order, and views about what might loosely be called cultural values. This is a process that happens particularly through the Nixon administration and Nixon's efforts to capitalize on Southern discontent at desegregation continues through the Reagan administration and has gone on unabated until today. A consequence of that is that today, unlike in the 1940s or 50s, maybe even the early 60s, you have two political parties that are that don't have much overlap in terms of substantive preferences, in terms of policy preferences, and that are that have very, very clear identities with respect to questions about race and with respect to questions about which are now loosely coded under the term culture wars. A consequence of that change in our degree of partisan polarization is a change in the nature of the kinds of judges who are going to be selected, nominated, and confirmed by Republicans as opposed to Democrats. I'm not sure whether one or the other period of time, the 50s or the, let's say, the last decade, has produced more legitimate judges. Right, I think you'd need to unpack what the word legitimate means. What I would stress is that the kind of judges being appointed in the 1950s and the kind of judges being appointed today are very, very different because of the underlying differences in our partisan polarization at the national level.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Well, let me jump in and ask this then. The speculation, of course, is that the decision granting the right to abortion is going to be reversed, overruled, I should say. Where is the idea of judicial modesty in this? That is, the idea that judges aren't there to determine the way our lives are going to go based on their own personal preference. Because it strikes me that these judges who are on the court now who are going to vote to overrule Roe v. Wade are taking a very different approach to judging than anything we've ever seen before in our history. Is that hyperbole or is there truth to that?
I think that there's both truth to it and I want to put some caveats to it.
Yes, please.
What I would stress, and I think I've been trying to stress it, but I'd stress it again, is that we have a political appointment process. We have a process where judges are selected by the president, and then they're voted on by the Senate. Both the president and the Senate are clearly not just political bodies, but they're highly partisan bodies. They're driven by partisan forces. And because of the failure of those two assumptions that I flagged earlier on in our conversation, the assumptions made by Hamilton and other framers that there would be constraints upon the operation of partisan forces when it came to the appointment of judges. Once those constraints fall away, we're going to have a judiciary that reflects in important ways partisan interests, and they're going to judges are going to exercise whatever discretion they have in ways that influence or that reflect the priorities and the beliefs that come with their partisan identity. That I don't think has changed through time. I think that we have a court that can decide a case like Brown v. Board of Education because it's staffed with people who are newly sensitive to the situation of African Americans in the South. And that sensitivity is a partisan matter. And you can think that's a good thing or a bad thing, but the point that I want to make is just that it is a change that happens in the 1950s because of the changing partisan dynamics of appointments. Today, we have a judicial...
Uh-oh, we're ready.
...by those partisan influences, but we're in a moment of not just partisan polarization, but hyper-polarization, much, much bigger degrees of polarization that we've seen at least for the past 70 or 80 years. Where the party that has played the dominant role in appointments to the Supreme Court since the 1970s, the Supreme Court has not had a majority of Democratic appointed judges since the end of the 1960s. I think it was either 1969 or 1970. The Republican Party has appointed a majority of judges to the Supreme Court since the for the last 50 years. That party has moved dramatically to the right over the last 10 years. That's a function of the Trump presidency, but it precedes the Trump presidency. It has the president, and this is not just President Trump, but it's also President Bush, one and two, have used their appointment power in ways that reflect that movement to the political right. So what we have today is, as before, a court that reflects underlying partisan gaps, but unlike before, we have a court that reflects the partisan partisan distribution, which is quite far from the median voters' preferences in the United States. Right, if you look at the ideological scores that are called the Quinn Martin scores, which are calculated for each one of the individual judges on the Supreme Court, the justices today are more to the right than has been true for the last century, and they're far, far, far to the right of the median American voter. And in consequence, what you're going to see it from that out of that pattern is a series of decisions that reflect interests that are or understandings of the Constitution, understandings of federal law that are in many instances dramatically out of step with the understandings and beliefs of the much of the American public.
Well, what you seem to be suggesting, and I might be wrong about this, is that we have less reason to complain about the court, less reason to apply criticism, because what you're saying, I think, is, well, all of this is to be expected. This is what the process produces. And we just happen to be in a moment when they are able to get, the Republicans were able to get three or four really conservative, or you can even call them reactionary, justices on the bench. Now, I want to go back to another idea of this. It's all related. Would have happened back in in the Brown versus Board of Education case, 1954, what would have happened if it had been 5-4? Because we know from all the internal documents that there was a tremendous push to make sure it was unanimous. Isn't there a kind of influence that says when you're dealing with something so utterly important as individual rights to someone's body, as well as education, like the abortion case, that it should be unanimous?
I want to just respond, Bill, to the first thing you said, which was, I'm not trying to legitimate or to say that any decision taken today is valid or
I'm not suggesting that.
What I would say is that I think I'd make two. I reiterate that what I'm trying to do is to give an account of the underlying mechanisms through which something is happening. I think that one thing that's implicit in what I'm saying is that I don't think that either the questions of remedies that my book is focused upon, or even the kind of headline questions about constitutional rights that many people hear about, particularly in June when the big decisions come along, questions about abortion questions about the Equal Protection Clause, questions about the Second Amendment. I don't think that it is plausible to say that these are questions that can be answered mechanically by applying some pre-existing rule that is to be found in the text of the Constitution. I think if you look at the history, and if you look at the text and the history and the understandings of the people who enacted key clauses in the Constitution, even at the moment of enactment, there is often dramatic disagreement about what that language means. Even at the moment of enactment, there is profound uncertainty and lack of knowledge about how a particular clause might be applied in the future. And though that gap between the text of the Constitution that we have and the particular concrete controversies that come before any court has to be bridged not just by some sort of mechanical application of law, it has to be bridged by making what are inevitably normative judgments about the value of equality, the value of liberty, the value of bodily autonomy from state control that are not entirely resolved by the Constitution. So I am absolutely not trying to justify anything, especially not the reversal of Roe v. Wade, which is something that I think is wrong.
I wasn't suggesting that. I was simply trying to. Okay, I was just trying to isolate the idea.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I get that. I'm making my position clear.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. Now, and this is actually really helpful because what you're doing is you're pushing me to clarify things, which is great.
Okay. Now I want you to talk about something else that's not in your book, which is this wonderful piece you wrote for Politico a week or two ago about Justice Alito. Tell us about that piece. It's about the anger that Alito is imposing on the country, I would say, and why you wrote the piece against the backdrop of this book. Can you do that?
Yeah. So the piece points out that both in the draft Dobbs opinion and across a range of earlier both opinions and public occasions, Justice Alito has expressed himself in ways that signal a profound emotional commitment that shapes his jurisprudence. And I point out language in the draft Dobbs opinion. There's the repeated use of the word abortionists, for example. There's language that is, I think it's fair to say, contemptuous of the judges who wrote the original Roe opinion. I think if you look back at his earlier decisions, there's language which is hyperbolic with respect to, or language which is, hyperbolic may not be the right word, language which expresses alarm in, again, in an emotional register about the plight or the perceived plight of people who oppose gay marriage, people who are religious, who might have to accommodate people who are LGBTQ, or accommodate women who are seeking contraception. And there is no equivalent language. There is no equivalent attention devoted to the plight of people who are, for example, victims of police violence, women who are, for example, seeking reproductive choice because they are they've been victimized by sexual violence or by incest. There is no even-handedness in the nature of the emotional concern that Justice Alito demonstrates with respect to different kinds of litigants. It's asymmetrical rather than being symmetrical. And I think one way of reading that pattern that is evident in the text of his opinions is in light of a particular political identity that is salient today and that has been salient, I think, for the last 30 or 40 years. The idea of an embattled white Christian minority that sees its traditional way of life being, or what it views as its traditional way of life, being threatened by first the process of desegregation, and then second by cultural and then legal changes such as the right to abortion, the right to gay marriage or same-sex marriage that have emerged over the last 20 to 30 years.
Go ahead, sorry. I was going to say, wouldn't the average citizen have a pretty good gripe to be able to say, well, why is that person on the court? How can personality fuel or drive decisions? It's clear that his personality, his anger, is driving the decision. It's not based on law. It's completely opposite to what judges are supposed to do. Wouldn't the average citizen have a pretty good complaint?
So I think that the complaint that I would lodge, or the point that the critique that I would push is not to draw a distinction between decisions that are made on the basis of law and decisions that are made on the basis of values, but to say that this is the wrong or a bad set of values, and I fundamentally disagree with those values. And I think that they're the wrong values to have in a judge. Why do I draw the distinction between those two things? I take the decision in Brown v. Board of Education, right? A decision that I think most of us think is clearly the right decision and clearly a just decision. I don't think it's at all clear as a matter of the text of the Equal Protection Clause and the immediate history of school segregation, not just across much of the North, but even in places that were controlled by the federal government, such as the District of Columbia, right, which had segregated schools around the time that the 14th Amendment was enacted. I don't think it's at all clear that you can get to Brown by just some mechanical application of the law. I think you have to have a view about, well, why is segregation wrong? Why is Jim Crow wrong? How does it conflict with the vision of equal protection that is embodied and aspired to by the Constitution? That's a normative question. So I don't want to resist the idea that you can somehow that decisions, particularly on constitutional questions, can be reached in some sort of mechanical way without appealing to values, right? So it's not that Justice Alito I disagree with Justice Alito because he's appealing to values. I think that those are values that are inconsistent with the vision of the best version of our constitutional scheme. A vision of the constitutional scheme that is not lopsided when it comes to taking account of the interests of people who differ by race or gender or vulnerability. I think that our constitution is best read as being inclusive, not being exclusive. And I would critique Justice Alito for content of his of the values that he brings to the table. I wouldn't critique him for the fact that he brings values to the table. I think that that's the wrong critique, at least in our constitutional system.
All right. I think I've pressed you as far as I can press you. I want to turn now to something altogether different, which is you as a writer. As I mentioned before we actually started recording, you're a very fine writer. You really are. You're very lucid. You're dealing with stuff that is difficult to write about because anytime anyone tries to describe what happened in a particular decision from the Supreme Court, they get lost in the details. You're a very fine writer, and I want to know, how did you become such a good writer? Who did you read? Where did you learn to do it? You didn't expect that question, did you?
I did not expect that question. That's a terrific question. And, I will say that as a parent of a preteen who is starting to have to write. It's something that I think about a lot. You know, here's what I would say. I had two careers before becoming a legal academic, and I think that both of them were careers that suited me to writing, not just writing with a sensitivity to who the audience is. I spent some time as a journalist working for a newspaper called disappeared, called the Hong Kong Standard, as well as writing for college papers and writing for you know, whatever occasional thing came around. And I was a litigator. And I think both the journalist and the litigator, I mostly wrote briefs. I was not a person who was in court regularly. I was mostly doing motion practice and appellate practice. I think both of those jobs are about communicating. And both of those jobs encourage a kind of ruthlessness about ego, right? Your job as a journalist, your job as a litigator is not to promote yourself, not to show off how well you can write. It's to communicate ideas, and it's to get across something to your audience. And when I now write, the one thing I try and think really hard about is, who am I writing for? Mm-hmm. And I'll say that the book, The Collapse of Constitutional Remedies, is in an Oxford University Press series where there's a very tight word limit. You're not allowed to go over 40,000 words. You're not allowed to have a lot of footnotes. And the editor's very, very clear. You gotta write this for a general audience. And so when I write for Politico, when I write for a general audience in the form of a book, I pay a lot of attention to thinking about, how is somebody who is not a lawyer going to read this? What, you know, is this sentence immediately opaque? Is it transparent to the non-lawyer? And I think that thinking about the audience rather than thinking about yourself is really a discipline I learned as a lawyer and as a journalist. Yeah. So I wish I could say I was better read than I am. And your question very fairly asked about what I, you know, about influences. But I think it's about practice. And I think it's about practicing, right? I'm sure I don't do this always, but practicing writing in a way where what you're thinking about is not yourself. You're thinking about your audience. And you're thinking about, how do I speak to this audience?
Well, I've always thought that the world of legal writing, at least as it taught in law schools, gets it all wrong, because they miss the most important point, which is what you've just described: know your audience. You're writing for an audience of 1 or 3 or 7 or 9, whatever the number is, but you know who your audience is. And you know, for instance, they read thousands of briefs. So you have to find some way to give them what they want and then get on with it. So, but I do want to know, and I don't want to obviously press you too much here, but who do you read that you not are influenced by, but admire?
I will say that, at the moment, if this is a what are you reading now kind of question, okay. If I can take it as that, is that all right?
Sure.
So, what I am reading now is, I am working my way through the magnificent body of work by John le Carré, mm-hmm. which I am embarrassed that I have never read before. And what strikes me about those books is, those books are only, I mean, they are espionage novels, but they are, you know, espionage novels in the same way that Bleak House, for example, by Charles Dickens, is a legal novel. Mm-hmm. They are novels about human psychology, and they're novels about the movements of the human heart, and the way that those movements are often imperfectly understood or viewed by the people whose hearts are at stake. And the piercing thing that he does and that I admire greatly is to capture in words the way in which we go through the world only half understanding not just what's happening around us. Right. And that's the espionage bit. It's the who, you know, what exactly is the plot that I'm embedded in. But what Le Carre does consistently is to show that his characters don't just misunderstand the world, they misunderstand themselves. And they don't fully grasp their own drives and neuroses and worries and anxieties. And that is just a marvelous thing to be able to do, to show, to sort of be inside somebody and to show their mind working in ways where you can see the gap between what the person understands and what's actually going on. I think that's a tremendous thing. I wonder whether it's the kind of thing that had I read the books in my 20s, I would have totally missed. And whether it's because I'm reading them now and I'm in my 40s, whether my own experience of the world and my own sense of sometimes acting on the basis of things that I don't fully understand until after the fact. I think maybe it's that experience that age brings that allows me to appreciate the Le Carre books. But I it's a cliched recommendation, but they're a marvel to read. They're absolutely wonderful, particularly the so-called the Carla trilogy, which starts with Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy.
Pat, I just started rereading that. It's unfortunate that in our country he's not recognized as the writer that he is. That is a really fine writer, not just a genre writer. In England, they tend to think of him as transcending the genre, and I think that's justified. A really fine writer. He always strikes me in a way like Raymond Chandler. Really, they have the nuts and bolts of writing down perfectly, and then they infuse it with character analysis. I mean, in a way, George Smiley, the star of that trilogy you just mentioned, is one of the greatest characters in English literature. So
yeah, I certainly think that this is to your point that, you know, if you're a young lawyer, reading widely, not just reading in law or reading in political science or reading in economics, is incredibly valuable, because what you get if you have picked up and are familiar with, or at least in passing, some of the great literature that's available now, assuming you don't speak other languages, just available in English, is so many different ways of expressing ideas, so many different ways of using the language to be clear and to communicate. Mm-hmm. That any great writer, and I think Le Carre, as you said, is one of the greats, certainly of novelists, is great because they communicate. And your job as a lawyer is to communicate and to move people. And as you said, to move the judge who has 3 minutes to flick through your brief out of a stack of 100. And if you can grab that judge's attention, if you can communicate them, even while being clear, even while sticking to the conventions of legal writing, then you're doing a really good job, right? And I think that, you know, the more well-read you are, the more likely you are to be able to do that.
Oh, I agree. And just one person I want to recommend, I don't know how much you've read of Charles Fried, but he's another really gifted writer with a deep, deep store of learning that he draws on. And he hasn't gotten, he's, I think, in his mid-80s now, but he still has not gotten as much attention as he should get. And he's an interesting fellow because he's changed his point of view when it comes to some of the most important legal issues of our time. All right, well, that's enough for me. And you've been terrific, Aziz. You've really been terrific telling us what you think about the historical problems that the courts face and what's going on with the court today. I didn't ask you questions about your own time clerking the Supreme Court, which I would have been really interested to know about, but that's for another day. So again, thank you very much for doing this. And I'm going to conclude the recording, though I want to talk to you for a minute afterwards. So Aziz, thanks again for doing this.
Bill, thank you very, very much for having me. I really appreciate the chance to have this rich and terrific conversation.